From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one of the great jazz vibraphonists, Gary Burton. Many vibists have adopted Burton's four mallet technique. He'll tell us how he developed his unique style, and we'll hear what it's been like for him as one of the very few out-of-the-closet gay men in jazz. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season premiere of the resurrected NBC cop show, Homicide. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The State Department says North Korea has agreed to let international inspectors visit all seven of its nuclear sites. The State Department says this is an important step in solving a 10-month-old dispute between the United Nations and North Korea. But a senior State Department official says North Korea has not agreed to the inspection of two nuclear dumps, and the dumps first triggered the inspection crisis. Authorities on the East Coast say 13 people have died in incidents related to the giant storm that dumped snow over the past week. Thousands of people lost power, hundreds of travelers were stranded. Pittsburgh got more than a foot of snow, and more snow is forecast for today. David Naylor of member station WDUQ reports.
Finally, flights are getting off the ground at Pittsburgh International Airport. Officials say the bright sunshine is slowly melting the layers of ice and snow that accumulated during 15 hours of steady snowfall yesterday. The biggest problem now for the area appears to be impatience. A few accidents occurred this morning when commuters tried to travel too quickly on roads that appeared to be free of ice but were not. John Cowes is directing emergency operations for Allegheny County.
We have a lot of equipment in some of our municipalities that have been going around the clock, and we've had a number of breakdowns, and we're trying to supplement these municipalities with county equipment. And the goal today is secondary roads.
Another inch of snow is expected today. For National Public Radio, I'm David Naylor in Pittsburgh.
The government says factory orders rose 1.4% in November, the most recent figures available. The Commerce Department says this confirms ongoing growth in the manufacturing sector. The November rise is the fourth monthly increase in a row. It's also the largest since June of last year. Eight of the 10 major industry groups reported increases in factory orders, including a 5.5% jump in transportation goods. Sprint, the long-distance telephone carrier, says it has a new calling card that will completely change the way its clients use their phones. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Expect to see a barrage of Sprint ads in the weeks ahead, touting the voice-activated calling card, the latest product from the ever-changing telecommunications industry. Sprint's Dave Schmid says it's convenient, simple, and safe, and customers don't even have to say the number.
Just tell the network who to call or where to call. Like, call pediatrician. And the call will be placed, as simple as that.
The customer is assigned a personal 800 number and can pre-select up to 10 voice-activated numbers. A few thousand use Sprint's voice phone card. It will be offered to business customers later this year. Carol Van Dam, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 8.5 points at 3,792. Trading is heavy. The NASDAQ is up 3 at 777. This is NPR. The largest Japanese food processor says it's working on developing a vaccine to fight AIDS. Ajinomoto Company says the drug it's working on comes from a tuberculosis vaccine that also has part of a gene that is taken from Japanese and Thais who are infected with HIV, the virus that leads to AIDS. The drug has helped mice in recent testing to build up their immunity, but the company says the drug is being developed and it will take years of research and testing to see how effective it is. An American congressional delegation that is visiting Angola was forced to pull out of a planned visit today to the northern Angolan city of Malanje. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
The American embassy in Angola today blamed the UNITA rebel group for the cancellation of a visit by a U.S. congressional delegation. The plane carrying four congressmen was forced to turn away as it approached the besieged northern city of Malanje when the city's airport came under mortar fire. The plane was not damaged and returned to the capital, Luanda.
UNITA denied that it staged the attack. The delegation had hoped to visit Melange, about 200 miles north of Luanda, to assess the city's humanitarian situation. The city has been surrounded by UNITA rebels since Angola's civil war resumed a year ago. Tens of thousands there have reportedly starved to death. Earlier this week, the same congressional delegation was forced to postpone its visit to the province of Cabinda due to a UNITA attack on an American oil installation there. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
Russian news agencies are quoting the wife of former Georgian leader Zviad Gamzakhurdia as saying her husband has committed suicide. The reports haven't been confirmed. The Interfax news agency quoted Manana Gamzakhurdia as saying her husband killed himself December 31st. An aide to the current Georgian security minister said he's heard these reports but can't say if the leader was killed or took his own life. Gamzakhurdia was thrown out of power 2 years ago. He was later succeeded by Eduard Shevardnadze. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Gary Burton, is one of the great jazz vibraphonists. Self-taught on the instrument, he became a technical innovator as well as a lyrical interpreter. In the 60s, he was a pioneer of jazz fusion. In the 70s, while recording for the ECM record label, he helped create the reflective sound that label became known for. Since 1971, he's taught at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, where he's now dean of curriculum. Back in the 60s, he studied at Berklee, but he left the school to go on the road with George Shearing and then Stan Getz. Now Burton is one of the very, very few jazz musicians who is out of the closet as a gay man. Before we meet him, let's listen to some music. A little later, we'll hear an excerpt of his new album, It's Another Day. Let's get started with something from one of my favorite Burton albums, Dreams So Real, featuring compositions by Carla Bley. Gary Burton, welcome to Fresh Air. The vibes is a very uncommon instrument to start out on when you're young. I mean, you know, lots of families have pianos, lots of kids have guitars. You can get a trumpet in school, but the vibes, I don't know how you get access to it. How did you?
It was kind of coincidental. My older sister already played the piano, and my parents wanted me to take music lessons too. I was about 6 years old at that time. And so they said, well, pick something different. And in taking me around to see other instruments at school concerts and that sort of thing, one of the things we went to was a recital by a lady who played the marimba, which is a close relative of the vibraphone. So that's what I picked. I think probably because it was big and you hit it with sticks. You know, I'm sure I didn't have much criteria for making a reasonable judgment at that age. It was kind of just instinctive. And started playing the marimba, and then a year or so later added the vibraphone as well, and played both for quite a few years until I got interested in jazz. And since jazz and vibraphone go together, from that point on, all I wanted to do was play jazz, and I just stuck with the vibes.
How old were you when your parents actually bought you a vibraphone?
Oh, I was, marimba when I was six, and vibraphone, let's say I was probably 7 or 8.
They must have had confidence in you to spend that kind of money on what I'm sure was a very exotic instrument.
I suppose so. At the time, it seemed perfectly reasonable. I assumed that parents were doing this all over the place with
their
children.
Not in my neighborhood.
But I discovered as I got older that there were practically no other players of mallet instruments anywhere. And in fact, I never really saw a professional vibraphone player until I had gone all the way through high school and moved to Boston to go to college. I grew up in Indiana, so there weren't a lot of jazz musicians around, and particularly not vibraphone players.
Well, what were you listening to get a sense of how the vibe sounded before you started listening to jazz?
I really wasn't listening to anything. You know, this was the 50s, and people weren't as used to nonstop all day long listening to music as is now the custom. And I just played what music I could get my hands on. Usually it was sheet music from the music store that was written for piano, and I would sort of adapt it to the marimba or the vibraphone. And just learned lots of songs and played kind of concerts locally and around where I lived. And when I got interested in jazz, it was first sort of through Dixieland music. Benny Goodman was one of the first jazz musicians I remember hearing. But when I got into jazz, then I started a love affair with records and started driving, you know, an hour or two away to larger cities to find record stores to look through the jazz selection to see what I could take home.
When you started listening to Lionel Hampton or Red Norvo or Milt Jackson, was it a revelation?
Kind of, because I first thing I discovered was that I didn't play technically like the established players. Milt Jackson was the most famous vibist of that day and still is a major star on the instrument. And at the time, his style, you know, he is a two-mallet player. And I had been playing with four mallets because I played alone all the time and it was too empty without some harmony. And I wanted it to sound more complete, so I had continued experimenting with four mallets and learned to play the instrument somewhat as a solo instrument and as treating it as a keyboard instrument. And when I finally heard other players and saw them play later on, I realized that my approach was drastically different from the norm. And in fact, instead of becoming influenced by other vibraphone players, I turned to piano players to be my influences. And probably I could list three or four piano players who were the most important in terms of shaping my style of playing.
Did you do anything that would have been considered wrong? If you had a teacher, would your teacher have tried to talk you out of things that you are still doing now?
Probably not. The one thing that the people did tell me when I did ever meet a mallet player or read anything about it was the admonition that four mallet playing was impractical and had no future. But I had already been doing it enough up to that point that I didn't think that was true. I was finding that, in fact, it was a lot easier than it first appeared to be, that once you reached a certain point with it, it became pretty fluent and pretty natural. And so I sort of disproved the conventional wisdom of the time, which was that two mallets was the only way to play the instrument. You have to realize that the vibraphone is still a very young instrument as instruments go. It was invented in 1929 and didn't really get fully established until the 40s. So when I started playing it, it was only 20 years old as an instrument, and the technical possibilities for it were still waiting to be discovered in a lot of ways.
You use usually two mallets in each hand.
Right.
Does the relationship of one mallet to the other in one hand remain constant? Are you always playing the same interval?
No, they're changing. You think of them, in fact, as fingers. It's as if I'm playing a large piano keyboard and I've got four fingers and I'm constantly changing the positioning of the four mallets or these four fingers to make different chord combinations. And I use them singly as well to play single notes. It's not always just four-note chords that are going down. It's a constant variety between single lines and contrapuntal lines and voicings that may be two notes, three notes, or four notes.
If you're just joining us, my guest is vibraphonist Gary Burton, and he, by the way, has a new album. It's called It's Another Day. One of the first bands you went on the road with was Stan Getz. Pretty lucky break, I guess, to get started like that. But Getz has the reputation of being maybe moody would be a good a good word here.
I see you're up on your jazz history.
So what was it like when you were a young man? I think you were still a teenager. Getting started with somebody who was A, that good, but B, that temperamental.
It was a real education. And in fact, even years later, when I would run into Stan, we would laugh about it, and I would tell him that, you know, what an experience it was to spend 3 years working with him, that in some ways he taught me all the things that I shouldn't do in terms of how to approach my career.
You mean through his example?
Yeah, but at the same time, he was one of the most marvelous musicians and that I've ever known. And I learned so much from him, just from watching him play and how he dealt with the music and also how he dealt with his career. He was a very kind of intense and volatile person. So he was, you know, he really wore his emotions on his sleeve. And so that was a total opposite from me in personal approach to things. But it was a good education because Stan was representative of a type of artist. And I have met other people through the years who remind me of Stan. And whenever I find myself working with someone who is this type of artist, I always say, okay, I know how this works. I know how to deal with someone like this. I know how to work cooperatively with them because I had 3 years of experience with Stan, and that got me used to this.
Did he do anything to test you or to intimidate you early on?
Oh, immediately. the first encounter with him was sort of an audition. This was at a club in New York called Basin Street East, and he was actually looking for a piano player, but had been unable to find someone available and needed to find a replacement for the musician in his band. And someone had told him that I played vibraphone with four mallets and that perhaps I could substitute for piano. So he had called me up and told me to come down to the club with my vibraphone and sit in for a set and see what it sounded like. So I did. And it didn't go well at all. I didn't know many of the songs they were playing and or their arrangements. And I was kind of intimidated by Stan, who just his very presence sort of would make you nervous. And about halfway through the set, I was never sure when to accompany. I didn't want to get in the way because I didn't know the songs too well. So I would only play chords and comp occasionally just so he could sort of hear what it sounded like, but I didn't want to try to do too much and become a problem. But he apparently thought I was holding back and so on. So at some point in the middle of the set, he got totally red-faced and turned to me and sort of yelled, how come you're not comping when I'm playing? You only comp when he's playing. Is there something wrong with my playing? And it so, terrified me that I could hardly play at all for the rest of the night. And he said, well, didn't work out, so thanks anyway. And I figured that was the end of it. But he called back a week later because he still hadn't found anyone, and he was desperate now because he had 3 weeks of dates booked that were to start a few days later. And so he called me back in desperation and asked me would I do it anyway, even though it was clear that he didn't like my playing. And because the other guys in the band were friends of mine, I thought, well, I'll have a good time anyway. It'll work out. I'll do it. And for the first week, he didn't like anything I did and would yell at me all through the times we were playing. He would tell me to lay out because when my playing would start to bother him, he would make me stop and he'd play without me for a while. But by the end of the first week, I had begun to figure out how to fit into his band and what would work musically. And by the time the 3 weeks were up, it had settled into a nice combination, and so he said, well, why don't you stay on for the next tour? And then that ended up being for 3 years.
When he didn't like what you were playing and he told you to lay out, this was at a club in public?
Yeah, this was at, it was a tour of Canada. We were playing clubs in Montreal and Toronto, and so in the middle of the song, he would turned to me and yelled the word stroll, which was kind of an old musician's term for the accompanying the comping instrument to lay out. It was called strolling.
Isn't that embarrassing, humiliating to be told that in front of an audience?
It was. I had quite a bit of pride in those days. I guess maybe I still do, although it's tempered somewhat through years of experience. But at the time, I was considered a hotshot student from Berkeley, and I thought I was quite the player. And to have him, clearly unhappy with my playing was kind of a new experience to me. Anyone else I'd ever played with before always seemed to be pretty happy with what I was doing. And it was kind of a strange experience to have somebody who was so visibly agitated by my playing. But I noticed something during that 3 weeks that was a big revelation to me and started changing my playing. And which Stan was responsible for. I noticed that there I was, the hot young player, and I would solo my heart out when it was my turn, and then I would watch Stan when it was his turn, and he would play a lot fewer notes than me and a lot simpler. In many cases, he would play almost just the original melody of the song, just kind of paraphrase it a little bit, but play it so expressively that I'd look at the audience would just be totally captivated by what he was doing. And I woke up to the fact that there was something to do with how you handle melody that I hadn't really noticed or given attention to before. And I said, here's something I'd need to learn about, and this looks like the guy to learn it from. So it was a important time for me.
Well, let's hear Gary Burton recorded with Stan Getz in 1964 from the album Getz A Go-Go. The song is Only Trust Your Heart. The singer is Astrid Gilberto.
Never trust the stars when you're about to fall in love. Look for hidden signs or you begin. Never trust the moon when you're about to taste his kiss. He knows all the lines and lips so often lie. Just wait for a night when the skies are open.
Let's take a break here, then we'll talk more with vibraphonist Gary Burton. This is Fresh Air. Back with vibraphonist Gary Burton, who has a new album called It's Another Day that features singer Rebecca Paris. You've done something that I think exceptionally few jazz musicians have done, and that is you've come out. And I believe you've been out at the Berklee School of Music, where you teach, for about 5 years. But I believe now you're kind of coming out in a more public way. And I was wondering why you feel ready to do that now.
Well, sort of a combination of my own personal timetable and this changing attitudes, I think. Earlier on, I didn't think that people were ready to deal with that. And jazz in particular has a very macho kind of image to it. And I felt that I didn't want to confuse people who were following my music and kind of mixing up my personal life with an image that might confuse them. And but as time has gone on, I have felt a greater desire to just be myself and, you know, live openly what I am and who I am. And I also have felt increasingly comfortable with society's growing maturation on the subject, and felt like it would not be as drastic an issue. And so a few years ago, when I started being more open, first with friends and then where I work and people I play with, musician people in the industry and so on, I was very encouraged by the fact that I got nothing but supportive responses from people and encouragement from everyone. And that convinced me that it was the right thing to do. And it's certainly been a refreshing change in my life.
I've always assumed it must be difficult to come out in the jazz world, even to jazz musicians. And I reached that conclusion because there are so few jazz musicians who are out. I mean, I could maybe not think of any except for you. When everybody knows about some jazz musicians who are gay, and even those people who everybody knows about aren't out.
Well, I also wondered about that, the fact that there were no other musicians that were, at least that were well known, that were out. I know of a few, and I thought perhaps that my becoming more public about it would make it easier for others to deal with it.
Were you afraid that musicians wouldn't be accepting?
I was. I was worried about it, and I thought that, well, the worst that will happen is that a few of them will not want to work with me again, that I won't get called for some projects, and that I decided that, well, I guess after this many years, I would survive, and that I guess I would just have to deal with that, and that I was sure I wouldn't lose out on the chance to do, you know, all work, that I would still have some things that would be available. But I was really and frankly pleased to find that there was no change in my work pattern at all, that the same people were happy calling me up and happy working with me, and in fact would go out of their way to be supportive and encouraging and tell me that they thought it was just great.
Had there been times before you came out when musicians would, you know, make fag jokes or put down people who...
Absolutely.
Yeah. So how did you deal with that? What kinds of things came up and how did you deal with it?
I think the way everyone who is keeping it a secret does, which is you have a way of ignoring it and tuning it out. You have a way of not taking it personally. It's funny, those kind of jokes never bothered me until I came out. And then suddenly when I would overhear some kind of fag joke, then I would feel offended, like they were talking about me. And I would laugh at that. I would say, how did I do that all those previous years when I would hear those kind of jokes? And I would think it didn't apply to me. And that's, you know, our curious way of denying things, I suppose, and protecting ourselves.
Vibraphonist Gary Burton, his new album, It's Another Day, featuring singer Rebecca Paris, will be released later this month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Gary Burton will be back with us on the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation with jazz vibraphonist Gary Burton. 5 years ago, he decided to come out as a gay man. He's one of the few jazz musicians in the history of the music to be openly gay. We'll talk more about why he came out and what the reaction has been in the jazz world. Also, NBC's critically acclaimed cop show Homicide is back. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season opener. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Mexican government is offering to negotiate an end to the Indian peasant uprising in the southern state of Chiapas, but officials say the Indians must first give up their weapons. The rebels are protesting the condition of peasants. Many fighters have retreated into Mexico's southern jungles. Thousands of Mexican soldiers are suppressing the rebellion. Government warplanes have bombed several neighborhoods near a military base south of San Cristobal de las Casas. The army says it is defending itself. United Nations Ambassador Madeleine Albright is warning Croatia against further involvement in the Bosnian conflict. She issued the warning today after arriving in Zagreb, the Croatian capital. The BBC's Adams reports.
Mrs. Albright said the question of Croatia's involvement in the Bosnian conflict had come up frequently in discussions in Washington. She said the U.S. administration was very concerned about this and had sent repeated warnings to both the Croatian government and military. And in a clear challenge to Zagreb not to get any more involved, she said that Croatia might face sanctions if it did not change its policy. The warning is timely. Last week, President Tudjman said his army might intervene in the conflict if Muslim-led forces continued their attacks on ethnic Croats in central Bosnia. Mr. Tudjman's words have caused alarm among Western governments weary of the conflict in the former Yugoslavia. Diplomats in the region speak openly of their fears that the coming months may see not a breakthrough in the peace talks, but some kind of concerted effort by the Bosnian Serbs and Croats to bring about the final and conclusive partition of Bosnia.
Paul Adams reporting. Defense Secretary Les Aspin has used a new telephone hotline today. It connects the Pentagon with Russia. The phone link is part of the Memorandum of Understanding that was signed last year. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
Early this morning, outgoing Defense Secretary Les Aspin placed a direct call to his counterpart in Russia, Defense Minister Pavel Grachev. This defense telephone link is in addition to the president's hotline communications between Washington and Moscow. Aspin and Grachev talked for close to an hour. Aspin invited Russia to become a full player in the Partnership for Peace initiative, which President Clinton will propose at the NATO summit next week. The initiative would bring East European countries into NATO on a non-membership basis. Moscow has resisted the plan, but the Pentagon reports today that Grachev told Aspin he supports the concept and is interested in participating. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
The government says factory orders rose in November for the fourth month in a row. The Commerce Department says orders jumped 1.4% and transportation orders led the increase. Stock prices closed at a new high today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials rose nearly 15 points to end at 3,798. Advances led declines by a margin of 6-5 in heavy trading. This is NPR. Ford has announced a large recall. Owners of Tauruses, Sables, and Lincoln Continentals from the years 1989 through 1993 are being asked to bring them in because of a subframe rusting problem. More than 1 million cars are affected. In regions where road salt is used a lot, mountings that support the engine and transmission may corrode and separate. Ford says that it knows of 5 such cases involving the newly recalled cars, but it doesn't know of any accidents or injuries because of the problem. This week's big eastern storm has dumped several inches of snow in parts of Ohio and Kentucky, as well as through the Midwest. Marianne Zalesnik of member station WKNU has this report.
Electrical power has been restored to more than 15,000 customers in the eastern part of Kentucky. But spokesman for Kentucky Power, Tom Owen, says there are still 9,200 customers without service. Residents are also without power in parts of Ohio. National Guard troops in Kentucky have been using armored transports to move snowbound patients, assist power crews, and deliver fuel. Skies are just cloudy today, but the National Weather Service has issued a winter storm watch for the northern two-thirds of Ohio for late tonight and tomorrow. In southern Ohio, more snow is expected, but forecasters say temperatures could warm up enough to cause sleet and freezing rain. For National Public Radio, I'm Marianne Zalesnik in Highland Heights, Kentucky.
Reports from Yemen indicate hundreds of residents have taken to the streets in two cities to protest high prices and a drop in the country's currency. Reuters has quoted security sources who say troops are in the streets too and are containing the protests. But the situation is still tense. Most shops are closed. The country's estimated 11 million people face annual inflation of 100%, and the value of the rial, the country's currency, has been falling sharply. There's a political crisis. Two of the country's leaders are not speaking. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We're back with jazz vibraphonist Gary Burton. There are several composers whose work he's performed a lot over the years, including Carla Bley, Keith Jarrett, and Chick Corea. Let's hear a duet Burton recorded with Corea back in 1972 on their album Crystal Silence. Then we'll pick up where we left off in our conversation about what it's been like for him since he's come out as a gay man. There is a kind of heterosexual presumption in society. People are just assumed to be straight unless, you know, there's clues offering evidence otherwise. But I think that might be particularly true in something like the jazz world. Just there are so many jazz musicians who got started playing an instrument because it's easier to pick up girls that way. That's just that's such the standard answer. Like I didn't want to play drums because it took too long to put the drum kit away and all the women would be gone by then. You know? So how did you deal with that assumption? The assumption that, of course, you're straight. Everybody is.
I've come to look at it this way: that there are gay people who are more obvious about it. It's their style and their nature, and so people will tend to pick up on the fact that they're probably gay. And then there are gay people who do not exhibit stereotypical clues. And therefore, the assumption tends to be, on most people's part, you know, well, you start from a blank slate. We assume that they're straight. And then unless something tells me otherwise, I'll go with that assumption. So I knew from the beginning that people perceived me as being straight. And it was only on rare occasion that someone would actually ask me about it. And I would realize that the occasional person who would seem to pick up on it, but it was very rare. And I assumed from the beginning that it was probably a mistake to confuse people, because I wanted them to like my music, I wanted them to understand my music, and I wanted them to accept it on its own terms. I didn't want them to color their listening experience of what they were hearing with whatever concerns or hang-ups or views they might have on a social issue.
So what assumptions did you think they would make about you? Things like, well, how come you're not playing more show tunes? I mean, how did you think it would affect the response to your music?
There is an aspect of jazz, which is it's supposed to be high energy and intense and strong, and and therefore it implies masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this assumption that if you're gay, you're not masculine, which if anybody goes to a biker bar, they'll maybe get a different impression of that. But so that's a misconception that a lot of people have. And it's an issue in jazz, which I think also has harmed, been a barrier, let's say, for women players.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, there's this stereotypical expectation that jazz is a masculine kind of thing. And if the woman player plays light and soft and easy, it's said that she's not strong enough. And if she plays strong and heavy and intense, then it's said, well, you know, we're not comfortable with a woman being, you know, that heavy duty, that masculine, you know, we want women to be more feminine. And so there's always been this problem that I've seen women players wrestle with, because the public and other musicians have such a narrow-minded view of the issue. And so that was my worry too. I just didn't want to confuse people. And frankly, I grew up in the 50s and 60s. The climate was not very encouraging in those days. And I also grew up in a part of the country where I wasn't likely to find a community of gay people that I could identify with and that would help me understand my circumstances.
If you're just joining us, my guest is vibraphonist Gary Burton. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with vibraphonist Gary Burton. How old were you when you realized you were gay?
Well, it comes sort of in stages. That is, you wonder about it, and then you're not sure. At least in my case, I think it's true for a lot of gay people, because there's the expectations of society are fairly strong, and so at first you try to conform, and you assume you're conforming, and it gradually keeps surfacing as a reminder that something is different here. So I was aware, when I think back on it now, I was aware of it when I was a teenager, but I wasn't accepting it or facing it. I was sort of denying the clues. And I didn't really fully accept it until I was in my 30s, I suppose, and I didn't go become public about it until, you know, the last 5 or 6 years.
You were married for a while, weren't you?
That's right. Very happily so. This is also true for a lot of gay people, that there are many gay people with families, with children, and so on, because it was the more acceptable approach to life in the era I was growing up. And it seemed to work for me, and I was happy with it, during the years that I was married.
But you thought maybe you were gay even during those years?
Yeah. I knew I was capable of having a good relationship in either setting, was the story. And I knew that I could form either type of relationship. And so in a way I said, well, it's certainly more convenient to have a heterosexual relationship, so I'll go with that. And when my marriage ended, I sort of drifted around in the social world for the next few years, and that gave me a chance to re-examine how I wanted to see myself. And during all those years that had passed, times had changed quite a bit. And I realized that now it was possible to be as comfortable being gay as it had been for me to lead a straight life. And so I said, well, I think I would prefer that I feel more honest personally if I admit that that's my circumstances.
Was there a period when you had a secret life, when you admitted to yourself that you were gay, but you didn't really want anybody else to know yet, and you had a cover for yourself?
Yes, for a number of years, I, you know, just did the typical closeted thing, which was I had a few gay friends, I never crossed the line between that part of my life and all the people that I worked with and socialized with from the straight world. And I certainly never dreamed of telling other musicians that this was my real identity. And it always felt like I was living some kind of secret life, like I had a secret past that I was ashamed of or something.
How did you come out? How did you decide to tell the people who you work with at the Berklee School of Music and also the musicians who you play with?
Well, I started with the guys in my own band once I made the decision. And I figured that would be a good test case because they were good friends and I had known them for some years. And I thought, well, if they handle it well, then that's a good omen. And if they don't handle it well, I guess that would be a bad omen. So they were very supportive and good about it. And so that sort of gave me courage to continue gradually telling more friends. And I didn't actually make a public announcement at any particular point in time. It's just that, people talk. And once a certain number of people knew this about me, then they would tell others. And it was clear after a short while that pretty much everyone in my circle of friends and coworkers and so on, knew this about me. And I was happy to see that, it was accepted very, very well.
Did it take you a while to feel comfortable enough to bring a man with you to a gig?
No, curiously enough, once I realized that people knew and that the first reactions I was getting were positive, then I said, then this is no problem. So from that point on, I felt comfortable, being very open about it and didn't feel that I had to never mention it or that sort of thing. So my partner often travels with me to on trips that I go on and goes with me to events. When I go to the Grammys, he's with me, that sort of thing.
Do you wonder in the history of jazz who else was gay?
All the time. I've talked about it with friends. We've speculated on, possibilities. It's obvious that there are. I mean, and anybody who's naive enough to say, oh, well, there never were any gay jazz musicians is, obviously not very well informed. There are gay people in virtually every walk of life, in every profession and so on. And so there obviously have been gay jazz musicians from the beginning, but we'll never know for sure. And I'm not certainly not one to wildly guess about anybody because it may not be true. I've always been curious and to know who my predecessors happened to be. And I do think that there is no such thing as your sexuality influencing your music. I don't think you play a different way whether you're straight or gay, I've seen no evidence of that among musicians of any kind of music, and I certainly don't think it's true.
Now that you are out, do you want to become more of an activist in the area of gay rights, or try to be a model for other people who want to come out, or do you want to just kind of go about things as a gay person without making much of an issue about it publicly?
Mostly the latter.
Uh-huh.
That is, I don't want to be anything other than a jazz musician. I mean, that's what I do best. I don't do being a gay person all that great. that's sort of what I am. But what I do is play jazz. And that's what I want people to, pay attention to when I'm performing and when I'm, that, I mean, that's the message I have to give. On the other hand, I do want to serve as a role model and an encouraging influence for other gay people. I'm not interested in going to the straight world and saying, you know, I want to educate you about, you know, gay life. But I am interested in helping other gay people who might be wrestling with these same issues. And I've tried to be certainly helpful and encouraging to the gay students that I have encountered who are in music, and to anyone who ever stops to talk to me about it and ask me about it.
Gary Burton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Vibraphonist Gary Burton, he has a new album scheduled for release January 18th called It's Another Day, featuring singer Rebecca Paris. Here's a song from it called A Deeper Dream. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll discuss the dreadful weather in West Virginia. Almost 30 inches of snow fell in one county there. I'll talk with a United Nations official in Zagreb about the frustrations of the UN peacekeeping forces in Sarajevo and the rest of Bosnia. David Wellner reports from Chiapas, Mexico, on further developments in the uprising there of the peasant army over the New Year's weekend. Also, word from Chrysler Corporation, in one of their new models, they will not have an ashtray. We'll talk with a business historian about other artifacts from our motoring past.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It was a year ago this month that film director Barry Levinson, who did Diner, Good Morning Vietnam, Rain Man, and Avalon, presented the TV series Homicide, Life on the Street. This cop show got terrific reviews from critics who hailed its adult and realistic style, but it got little support from NBC or the viewers, and it was put on hiatus in the spring. Now it's back, and TV critic David Bianculli says this is the last chance to rally behind one of TV's finest hours.
It's almost funny. Homicide shows up in January 93, right after the Super Bowl, and is yanked by spring. The same month Homicide is pulled from the schedule on NBC, ABC announces that one of the shows that has made its schedule for fall is a new adult cop show called NYPD Blue. Come fall, and a lot of controversy, and NYPD Blue is the big dramatic hit of the season, applauded for its mature approach, its realistic feel, and its very interesting characters. ABC wins, NBC loses. Timing is everything. As much as I love NYPD Blue, and that's a lot, there's no question that Homicide is just as good and even more intense. It doesn't have David Caruso and Dennis Franz, but it does have Ned Beatty, Richard Belzer, Yaphet Kotto, and John Polito. And for tonight's second season premiere episode, it has a very special guest star, Robin Williams. Williams, who starred in Levinson's Good Morning Vietnam, plays a tourist. As the show opens, he and his wife and kids are taking in the local sights when they're attacked by some neighborhood toughs. After the opening credits, we learn that his wife was blown away while he stood and watched. The rest of the show has him filing a report, seeking justice, and, during the investigation that follows, getting to know the cops in Homicide. With Robin Williams as our guide, this episode of Homicide is almost like a second pilot, the perfect way to get to know these characters and this show. In one scene, Williams overhears one of the detectives, played by Daniel Baldwin, joking about the generic description of the suspects and the gun that the husband has given them.
Why is every civilian says the same thing about a robbery? Three nondescript yos with a hole in the end of the barrel the size of the Fort McHenry Tunnel. I am telling you, I am going to rack up the overtime on this one.
This funny to you?
You'll be able to put news.
It's a big joke, huh?
Mr. Ellison.
I want him off this case, okay? I don't want him anywhere near my family.
Look, I'm sorry about your wife. I know this must be tough on you. But I'm the primary in this case. You don't have a choice here.
I want to make a complaint. I want to make a complaint to his superior. Which guy is his superior? Okay, I want to start with you. I want to start now.
But later, Baldwin is the one who brings Williams the mugshots and who listens as the husband explodes with guilt and grief when he can't make a positive ID.
I can't say. Why, do you think it should be easy? Some sort of snap? Take another look. Take your time. It all happened so fast. Yeah, but I bet someone murdered your wife. You'd remember all the faces, wouldn't you? But I'm just an average guy. All I remember is the gun. I just stood there, staring at it. I just stood there and I watched him kill my wife. I didn't do anything. Yeah, but you would have done something, wouldn't you?
I'm not saying I would have done
anything. Oh, you're not saying anything, but you're thinking it, aren't you? I mean, hell,
it's a great episode, a great show, and for the next few weeks, NBC treats Homicide right and gives it a great time slot, 10 p.m. Thursdays after Seinfeld and Frasier. If Homicide had been there in the first place, it would have gotten all the attention and acclaim that NYPD Blue has gotten, at least after the nudity issue died down and people started looking at that show. But right now, what's important is for Homicide to attract enough viewers to survive. Given the economics of network TV these days, it's rare enough that Homicide has been given a second chance. So tune in and support it, because the show won't get a third.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Voblitis, and Bob Alls. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Devin Reif is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services, 1-800-643-3395. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the star of the former sitcom Get a Life gets a job as a cabin boy. We talk with comic writer and actor Chris Elliott about his new movie, Cabin Boy. And we talk with novelist Michael Ondaatje. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.